Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ethics, what do they mean anymore? Is there such a thing? Can you trust anyone? Should anyone trust you? Apparently, there is a line in the sand, and Jeffrey Seglin has been drawing it for several years now. He's the author of The Right Things, Conscience, Profit, and Personal Responsibility in Today's Business. He's also an associate professor at Emerson College in Boston, where he teaches writing and ethics, and he's a syndicated columnist. His column appears weekly in the Columbus Dispatch. You might be familiar with him, and he's with us today. Welcome to the show, Jeff.
Thanks, Ann. It's good to be here.
I stumbled over that word conscience. I hope that wasn't a Freudian thing. But I was wondering, what's the golden rule of ethics? I mean, if I could just ask you one question, I guess that would be it. Is it?
Well,
kind of...
you know, it's a great question because there is most every religion has some kind of form of the golden rule that everybody hears about, which is do unto others as others do unto you. And generally, that's a good thing unless the person you're doing something to doesn't care how you're treating them, and then you're kind of in a bad spot. So when I tend to look at ethics, I try to look at sort of the gray areas that people look at. Most of us know the stark differences between right and wrong that are extreme. You know, do I murder someone? Do I not murder someone? Most of us would know that it's wrong to murder someone. Where it gets really difficult is in everyday life, we're faced with multiple right decisions, and the challenge is to figure out what's the best right decision we can make.
Ethics and politics could be a full-time job for you alone.
Yes.
I mean, business, it's just a constant stream of issues. Constantly gifts to politicians become an issue. What do you make of all that?
Well, I think one of the things is that I don't know if it's worse than it ever was before or because of the accessibility on the internet and some of the terrific work of some bloggers. We're turning stuff up more than we've ever turned it before, where people are embellishing their records. Politicians are embellishing their records. Mm-hmm. They're playing fast and loose with their expense counts and how they combine the campaigning with the governance issue, which has become a big issue in Chicago lately, although mm-hmm. it's increasingly difficult to know when a politician is governing and when he's campaigning. but that becomes a huge issue because there are ethics rules and laws about that. So you'd expect them at least to pay attention to their own rules. I make of it that I'm always surprised, particularly in areas like Chicago, which has been just beaten up with the whole governor's scandal, how they continue not to pay close attention to play by the rules, at least while they're under such a close microscope.
There's also the issue of ethics in journalism. You're a fellow at the Poynter Institute in Florida. What are the issues of the day nowadays? It has the same thing to do with the internet access and that they're being more exposed, or are
well,
they worse?
It's some of that. I think there's a lot of stuff, as you know. I mean, there's a lot of stuff where it gets to sourcing. It gets to if everything's so immediate, are we doing as good a job in our due diligence of reporting? It also gets to the issue of how reasonable is it for some organizations to decide what to publish based on the number of hits they get on the website or how many times an article is emailed. Is that really what journalism is? Because obviously the business model is to stay in business, to publish newspapers or online publications. But if you're making your decision about what's important news based on how often the story gets emailed, then there's a lot of important news that's not going to get published. So there needs to be some kind of integrity to the process, and that gets, when money's tight, that gets really tough to stay straight on. Unfortunately, there are papers who are doing a decent job of that, but it gets very tough.
There's been a lot, not immediately recently that I can remember, but there seemed to be a spate of particularly columnists who were plagiarizing and just making things up.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's gone way back. I mean, that's gone way back where they're making stuff up. It's never forgivable. The part that baffles me the most is some columnists have been called on the fact of plagiarizing themselves, where if they've been writing for a long time, the deadline gets so much pressure that it's not just that they, tackle an old idea in a new way. They run an old column mm-hmm. that they ran. And that's, I don't know why, the columnists don't get to the point where they say to their editors, look, I'm overwhelmed. I need some help here. This is what I'm thinking. And instead do this. So there has been a spate of that. But that goes way back to the 80s when, there was a case in Boston where a freelancer writer for the Money section had written something as simple as a It was a bibliography of the best personal finance books that you could have for your library. And it turns out that if you didn't want to read the books, instead of just going to the bookstore and looking at the money shelf and picking out names, he lifted something out of Money Magazine. And so you'd think that this would be a career ender, and it was for his career at the Globe, but he's now an editor at one of the biggest alternative weeklies in town. So it doesn't always have, what's the right word, deleterious effects, although that's something that's going to be part of his legacy.
But it does have a deleterious effect on people's trust in the newspapers, particularly in journalism in general. It gets worse all the time. You remember, I can't think of her name now, but the Washington Post reporter Janet Cook. I was in journalism school at the time, and they had us go out, and because it was such a scandal, ask people what their opinions were of newspapers. And I was shocked then. I was very naive.
Right.
But it doesn't get any better.
No, there was the whole piece where she made up the story of a boy who was
a drug addict.
A drug addict, mm-hmm. Like the child. I mean, I think an adolescent.
Like a 6 or 7 or 8 year old, something
and
like
that.
And
it was a composite of several different things, and a lot of it was made up, and it was just they rescinded her Pulitzer. And after that, we had the example of Stephen Glass at the New Republic, who just made stories up.
Very creative writers too.
Well, yeah.
Wow, they were good writers.
He's in the wrong business,
right?
So it's amazing that he gamed the system, because in magazines, unlike newspapers, where the copy editor is your best defense for fact checking, there's no formal fact checking department at most newspapers. There are at magazines, and there was at the New Republic, and he knew how to game the system so he could get stories by the fact checking department. So it was just, if people want to cheat someone, and if they want to take shortcuts, they're going to do it. It does have a terrible effect on people's impression of the industry. I wrote a column a while ago when I was first starting to teach at Emerson. I had never been a professor or anything. I just come there to help develop their magazine publishing program. And when we're pulling up in front of the building to leave books and stuff in my office, on NPR comes a report about the latest Gallup poll on the most trusted professions. And in the top three is college teachers. And so I'm looking kind of smug and everything, and my wife just looks at me and groans. And then it mentions that in the bottom three is online journalists. So, and I was writing, my column is online as well. So she then kind of giggles at that, and presents, I'm the same guy, and yet the perception is based on my industry. So, I told her it really presented a problem when I go to cocktail parties about how I introduce myself, whether I introduce myself as a college professor or as a journalist.
Know your crowd, Jeff.
Yeah, I know. Well, she pointed out I don't go to cocktail parties. So
right.
But it is, that perception is terrible, and it remains terrible. I mean, we barely eked out above used car salesmen. And all of us, all of us at one time or another, I assume, have met a car salesman we don't think is the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that a handful of journalists doing shoddy work or bad work is giving the vast majority who are doing good work a tough time.
Right. We have a call now from Sean. If you'd like to give us a call, dial 614-292-8513. And I hate it when I say dial. Sean, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Hey, I'm going to say something nice about journalists.
Okay.
I've been a longtime subscriber to the Dispatch, and it's gotten thinner and thinner and thinner as the papers had to make a lot of hard choices. And I read your column every week, and I just wanted to pass along that I think the Dispatch has done a great job with in very trying times, with trying to keep itself relevant and engaging, and some of the longer form pieces, research pieces that have been done in the last couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I got my subscription notice a while back, and I think my rate went up a lot, and I kind of choked on it when I first saw it. And I thought, okay, is this worth making an investment in? And then over the course of the next 2 or 3 weeks, there were a couple long form pieces on the sports pieces that they did even this week.
Right.
They did some things on the schools, I think, last week.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nobody else doing that type of work in the city at all. And it's so important that the Dispatch is taking the time to focus on local issues and do the research and the digging that nobody else is doing. So I just want to encourage people, after you write your check to public radio.
Thank you, Sean.
Write a check to the Dispatch, because if we lose the Dispatch, there's nobody spending time to do any journalism of any depth in Ohio, in Columbus at all.
And, of course, when you said you read the column every week, you're talking about Jeff's column.
Jeff's column, yes.
Yeah. because for a second there I was going to say thank, but I don't do that anymore. Well, Sean, thanks for your call.
No problem. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin. He is the Right Thing columnist. You probably see him in your Sunday Dispatch. So if you'd like to talk to him, you can do that. Or you could go to Twitter us at Ann Fisher, WOSU, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Do you get recurring questions from readers, Jeff, that sort of, you know, they're the same question, they come in different, you know, they're clothed differently each time?
Yeah, I do. And it's not the ones that I would have thought that I would get. People seem to be very troubled about I shouldn't laugh about this because it's a serious issue, but the one thing that comes up a lot is when people deposit their trash in someone else's trash receptacle. People get really worked up about that, and I imagine when it's happening to you, it's a really visceral kind of response, but that becomes a big issue. And the other thing that's been a recurring issue is whether it's ethical to tap into a Wi-Fi signal, a wireless signal, mm-hmm. if it's not your own. And that comes up pretty regularly, and I took heat for saying that I think it's fine because I think that it's the responsibility of the person whose wireless signal it is to set up a secure connection with a password. I don't think it's fine to bypass a password protected wireless signal, but I do think it's okay if it's open, you know. And I think that I must get that every 2-3 weeks. I get an email from someone asking me if that's okay to do, and usually it's because someone's in between setting up their own wireless signal, and there are people who basically suggest that I'm giving permission to people to walk through someone's house or door or open door when I do that. But I disagree. I think that it's the responsibility of the person whose wireless signal it is to just set it up. If they don't want people to use it, they shouldn't use it. So.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. Our guest, Jeffrey Seglin, the Right Thing columnist. If you would like to talk to him, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back on All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At noon, Fresh Air will be here. Merle Haggard, Willie Nelson, and George Jones are some of the musicians Fresh Air will feature during their Country Music Week, which starts today. First up, Charlie Hayden. He's known as a great jazz musician, but he grew up performing country tunes alongside his brothers and sisters. Charlie Hayden is in the country lineup for Fresh Air. It begins at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. CCAD offers continuing education classes where you can update your creative career skills. Classes start September 13th. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
85 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:20 this morning. Sunny skies today and a high of 92. Clear skies tonight and a low of 70. More sunshine tomorrow and a high of 93. This is WOSU 820 NPR News, and All Sides continues.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin. He is a professor at Emerson College. He is also the columnist you see in the Sunday Dispatch. He writes the Right Thing column. If you have a question or comment for Jeff, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Jeff, have you ever been stumped?
I sometimes hold on to questions for quite a bit of time to figure out a response to them because, again, I don't think there's any one right answer to a lot of these questions, and so it's often trying to sort of struggle with what the best right answer is. There was a woman in Richmond who wrote me once, and her ex-husband, when they were courting before they were married and then divorced, gave her a skull as a gift. And it turns out that he had somehow taken it from a local cemetery. And she was writing me to say, what should I do? And the problem is that, you know, by talking to her and talking to various people, it's against the law to do that. And the laws vary state to state, but they were pretty strong in Virginia. So she wanted to return the skull and wanted my help in doing that. And I don't want to take possession of a skull. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out what the right solution for that is for her. And that was a hard one to figure out what to do. I mean, the right thing was for her to return it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a tough one because she didn't steal it. But she was holding on to it and only later, much after the fact, knew what was going on. So things like that that get very personal and expose people in responding to them get hard.
You know, something like this, you reminded me of something that's popped up for me. I learned from interviewing a bird expert that it's against the law to collect wild bird feathers.
Huh.
And I'd never known that before and felt a little guilty and ran home and, you know, tossed them. But I didn't really go out. But I guess the reason behind that is that if there becomes a market for it, if it's legal, then there could be a market for it. And then people could be plucking birds all over the place to get the
right
pretty feathers. And if it's illegal, then it's just flat out illegal. It doesn't matter what. But I come across people who collect wild bird feathers. And I wonder, what's the ethical thing to do?
Well, I think you can tell them and leave the choice to them. I think just like this interview subject told you, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'd be curious to know if the people who collect them know
right.
that there's a law against that, and presumably they don't. I mean, or maybe they don't. And it's an awkward position to be in, but I think pointing it out to them is reasonable.
You know, I guess it's kind of like that idea of you don't want to sound preachy, and that was sort of the next question on my list to you is how do you do it without how do you do what you do without sounding preachy?
I know in your case, it would have been possible to just say, "Geez, I used to collect feathers as well," and it freaked me out a little bit, so I went home and got rid of them for doing that. It seems like you are right, though, that there is a difference between I'm assuming you're not plucking the feathers from the birds themselves
right.
when you did it.
And
there's a qualitative difference from, you know, picking them up off the ground when they've fallen versus plucking them out. And, it seems like in that particular case, it seems like the law is curious because, there are lots of laws that we have that seem to respond to a situation that isn't yet a problem,
mm-hmm.
which is why we don't see seesaws in playgrounds. The fear of litigation is much more than there actually being ever. According to the guy who runs the Common Sense Foundation in New York, mm-hmm. there's never been a case of someone being sued over a seesaw.
Really?
Yeah. So it's been amazing that people do things out of fear of litigation, which is not an ethical response. It's a mm-hmm. financial response. You're afraid you're going to get sued for something that may happen.
So how do you, when you write something, particularly if it's something that it seems like a no-brainer to you,
right.
how do you temper it?
Well, I mean,
maybe it's just your nature.
I try not to be preachy with doing stuff, but sometimes in the questions that people ask me, it's clear that they know something's off in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So when they ask about whether or not it's okay to continue taking, a stream of income from someone when they know that person doesn't know they're still paying it, and that it should have stopped years ago. Well, when they tell me it should have stopped years ago, it's clear they know it should have stopped years ago, and they're looking for someone to either validate them or confirm their suspicions that what they're doing is just wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm more than glad to do that. But I try to do it in a way where I often talk to them after they write, or I go back and forth on email with readers and just try to get at the heart of what it is they're actually asking. That's often the most challenging thing is, figuring out what it is they're asking. Because mm-hmm. clearly a lot of people struggle with things, but they don't always know the question they're asking
mm-hmm.
of what's right and wrong. If someone writes me, I rarely take on consumer rights issues, but an elderly woman in Utah once wrote me about the fact that she went to her car dealer because the red engine light was on. And it turns out that the service engine light was on, and it turns out that if your gas cap is loose, sometimes the service engine light will come on.
Hmm.
So instead of just checking that for her, they put her car and charged her a couple $100 for servicing. And it turns out that it was the gas cap. And she was furious, and they wouldn't listen to her. So I talked to the guy who owned the local car dealership, and he refunded her money, and she had a terrific response to me. She said, why should it take me writing to you to get him to do what was the right thing to do all along? And she's absolutely right, that the right that was a, just not a good thing, and it's terrible customer service, and it's not particularly ethical.
614-292-8513 if you want to talk with Jeff Seglin. He is the Right Thing columnist. If you have a question or comment about ethics, Jeff's your man. There's a new marketing tactic. Well, let me ask you this, though. I was wondering, are there cases where – is it always unethical to break a law? Or are there cases where the law is unethical? Or how does that work in your mind?
Well, there's two parts to the question. One is just because something's legal doesn't mean it's right. So there are lots of people that follow the letter of the law and are often unethical people. And we saw this through the financial crisis, where some people were breaking laws, but the vast majority were not breaking laws, but they were barely following the letter of the
law. They were gaming the laws.
Yeah, they were gaming the law. And so laws only protect us so much. There are sometimes, if a law is wrong, it's ethical to break it. I mean, and we saw this through the civil rights movement, where it was legal to have, separate lunch counters and separate restrooms and separate schools, and that was worth fighting. I mean, that was deemed to be worth fighting, and it was successfully fought to point out that in breaking the law, justice was served. So there's often cases like that. That's an extreme example. It's not fair to say that because I don't like the law, I can break it. There's lots of laws we don't like. Going slightly over the speed limit comes to mind. Many people do it, but it's a law, and it's not particularly ethical to break it, even though I know I do.
But only as soon as you see the gauge, you slow it down. You take it for what it is.
If I were paying attention enough.
Hey, does the issue of sexual harassment pop up very often these days for you?
You know, it did early on, and it does every time there's a CEO of a big company like Heard from Hewlett Packard or Stone Cipher from one of the large aircraft companies. But it doesn't come up as much as it did it came up a lot during the Clinton years for obvious reasons. But it doesn't come up as much now. But occasionally it will come up. And that's a case where if the sexual harassment is going on, it's clearly both illegal and unethical. There's also the issue of bullying that comes up a lot in the workplace, which may not be sexual harassment, but there was a case that's going on now where an editor of a literary journal committed suicide because there was a perception that his managing editor was bullying him. That stuff comes up. And there's an ethical issue to how people treat employees.
614-292-8513 or send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. Is there an ethical question that's burning in your mind? Give us a call because Jeff Seglin answers those questions. There is a new marketing tactic out there. It's called unbranding. For example, a handbag company sends one of its competitors' bags to the one of the stars of one of those ridiculous reality television shows,
as opposed to the non-ridiculous ones.
Yeah. Well, I'm generalizing there. They all are mostly, except for my favorites. And they do that so that one of these obnoxious people on the show is carrying the bag of their competitor, and it kind of lowers its value or lowers its, the lux factor, I guess.
Right.
What about something like that?
I don't know. I mean, it strikes me as, perhaps appropriate sleazy given the route they're taking.
Yeah, right.
But I don't know if they're crossing ethical lines because I don't – unless they're saying they're someone they're not. If they're misrepresenting themselves and saying they're from that company that's providing the bag, that crosses all kinds of ethical lines because you're lying. If they're just sending it and it's clear they're identifying who they are, which is a bit bizarre, I don't know that there's anything wrong with it. It's just strange. There is, with the whole BP stuff going on, there's the whole issue come up again about greenwashing where a lot of the PR, it's tough because it's tough to gauge how sincere people are. And so the greenwashing is this idea that we're going to do a lot of PR that's very positive and shows how green we are and how wonderful we are when in reality all we're trying to do is cover ourselves for things that we aren't really doing. And that's not to say that BP is doing that. It's just to say that there's been a perception that with both them and other companies, they go into this whole green movement not because they think it's good for the environment, but because they think it'll get them good PR. So it's sort of that idea of you're following the law for the wrong reason. You're behaving in a way that isn't particularly ethical. It's because it'll pay off for the company. That doesn't mean it's a bad thing. It just means it's not particularly ethical because no thought has been put into it.
614-292-8513. Kieran, welcome to the show.
Hi. If you want to hear about unethical behavior, it's legal, but I believe it's extremely unethical. I work for Ohio State, and I had 24 years worth of pay raises taken away because of House Bill 187. OSU's lobbyists lobbied so effectively. It took them about 4 or 5 years to get it passed.
What does it do?
Well, what it does is it guts a lot of, you know, how Ohio State employees are state employees, but they can lobby for different things that the other Ohio State employees have, like protections. Well, when my job was abolished, normally all my pay raises would have gone with me when I was placed into a new job.
Mm-hmm.
But because of this legislation, they took away 24 years worth of raises. So I went from making almost $20 an hour to about $10 an hour. It cut my paycheck in half, and it was totally legal. And they also, that House bill also did a lot of devastating things to OSU's employees. It took away a lot of the handicap protections. Someone should look into that because I don't think the Ohio general public knows how devastating that was to OSU's employees.
Okay. Jeff, what about it? Thank you, Karen. What about institutional ethics?
That's a tough one because institutions aren't people, but there's a culture that sort of builds up within an institution about what's regarded highly and what's not regarded highly. So if it's clear that an institution, you know, promotes people who are, you know, fast and loose with expense reports or who try to undermine their employees or who do everything they can for themselves but not for the people around them, if that's perceived to be the culture of the place, then the ethics of the institution become called into question. Because, you know, you see that that's how you get ahead of the place, and that sort of becomes the way things are throughout the organization. You have to ask yourself at some point, is this really the place I want to work? There was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about a couple weeks ago that I don't know if you saw that said, unlike what you'd believe through Machiavelli and stuff, most people who rise through an organization are actually the nicer people. They're not the creepier people, much to, you know, anybody's personal experience. But once they get into a position of power, they're miserable to the people below them.
Power corrupts.
Yes. And it was a fascinating piece that ran, I think it was in one of the weekend Wall Street journals. And it just was fascinating because it shows what power can do to people. But I think institutions can have cultures that are pervasive throughout the organization. You know, Johnson & Johnson for years was perceived as being, partly because of the Tylenol scare in the 80s, was perceived as being this honorable and wonderful company. And that lasted for decades. And then it's only within the last, 5 years, 6 years that Johnson & Johnson has been under a lot of scrutiny because of recalls, because of various things going on. So it really calls into question of who's minding the store.
Okay, thanks, Kieran, for your question. We have a question from Sean on Facebook. He writes, how does one get qualified to write a column such as Jeff's? How does he confidently give such guidance without doubting himself or his qualifications?
My graduate work is in you know, theology and ethics. But what I had done before I was a college professor, I worked at Inc. magazine in Boston and wrote various features on ethical decisions that business owners make. And then after that was when the Times asked me to write a monthly business ethics column, which led to the weekly column. So I think in terms of credentials, I'm a writer first and foremost, and I report the stuff and write the stuff. And it just happens that the graduate work I did was in the field.
Do you find, Jeff, when you're doing your work, that you do reach back to the religious philosophy background?
You know, I,
and
A little bit. I think what I teach business ethics or ethical decision making at various executive MBA programs. Most recently at Virginia Commonwealth down in Richmond, they have a program that meets, you know, like 40 weeks for all Friday, all Saturday, and all Sunday, and I go down and teach. And I find that's been great about forcing me to go back and look at you know, there's the normative philosophy. Ethics, which is kind of the Aristotle and Mill and Kant and all of that. And then there's the applied ethics, which is what I write about. And when I'm teaching it, I can't just talk about the applied ethics with giving some foundation, because when you give those foundations, it shows there's different ways of looking at the world ethically. And that helps point out to people in business, or when I teach it at Emerson, it points out why there are arguments. People just look at the world differently. Some people are very rules-based and believe there should be rules that affect everyone. Some people believe that there's a greater good. So I do go back and look at that, because it helps me sort of work through my thinking in both in the column and when I'm teaching.
I was interested in a conversation that you wrote about. You'd overheard it at a baseball, the Cape Cod Baseball League game. And, and you asked your readers whether a fundraiser for a private high school should be should be blabbing about who gives what. Can you tell us about that?
You know, I was at the Falmouth Commodores game. It's one of the baseball teams that I go to see with my grandsons. And I was sitting there, and there was a conversation going on behind me, and I heard someone mention someone's name, and the person who they mentioned it to said, "Oh, I know so-and-so, they're very good to us," and then named the amount the person gives every year by saying he's good for such-and-such every year. And it just made me think, you know, what's the ethics of that? I mean, it's fine for someone to say he's very kind to the organization, but when they got very specific about how much he gives every year, it seemed to cross lines. So I posed that question to readers and said, what was going on here? Was it perfectly fine for this person to do that? Was the person out of line for doing that, or was it my fault for eavesdropping on a conversation? So I thought it could be any of those. I think the person crossed the line by being very specific with the amounts, because while that information gets printed, usually if it's an educational institution, mm-hmm. you know, the names of donors and stuff, it seems like a baseball game is not the place to be blurting out the names of people who give to your organization and the amounts they give.
Yeah, you're in mixed company. It just seems sort of tacky.
It does. It seems tacky, but it also it seems to cross the line in terms of privacy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that came up with that, and it, you know, I think my wife was more appalled than I was, but I found it pretty distasteful.
Okay, we're going to have to take another break. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin, columnist. He writes The Right Thing. You can see it in the Columbus Dispatch. When we return, we'll take your calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we kick off our Country Music Week with Jimmy Dale Gilmore, who will perform classic country songs.
Pick me up on your way down when you're blue and all alone.
And we'll hear an interview with jazz composer and bassist Charlie Hayden, who grew up in a country music family and returned to that music for a recent recording. Join us.
Pride and joy, but they'll find another toy, and they'll take home.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 85 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Sunny skies today and a warm day with a high of 92. Clear skies tonight and a low right around 70 degrees. Sunny skies for Tuesday and a high of 93. At WOSU, listener feedback is very important. Your thoughts on the conversation some of us have been having across the radio and web matter a lot to us. We're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for at least 1,000 listeners who can help. If you have a moment, please go to WOSU.org/survey to sign up and send us your thoughts. That's WOSU.org/survey. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Jeffrey Seglin, author of The Right Thing. It's a column in the Columbus Dispatch and all over the country, really. He's also written The Right Thing, Conscience, Profit, and Personal Responsibility in Today's Business. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Karen, you're on the show. Welcome.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good. So I wanted to ask you, Jeffrey and Anne, about the fact that the subject of ethics seems to have been standing out in high relief for me. My name's Karen Huff, and I run a company that does training, and we've done a lot of ethics training. And I think my question is in two parts. First of all, it's a sort of about your history. So I think back to my early 20s, and I feel like I did a few stupid things that I wouldn't do now, but I want to let myself off the hook for being in my early 20s. And sort of from a background perspective, like my grandmother, if someone gave her too much money in return, she had lived through the Depression and so much, and if she got all the way back to her car and looked down and realized she had too much change, her father would have told her it was stupid to go take it back. And, you know, since I've sort of grown up a little bit from there, I feel very differently than that. But she came from a different circumstance. So that's sort of the first part of the question. And then the second part is I think I've become so sensitive to even the tiniest violations because I see people in my clients being fired for stupid little infractions, like a fake cab receipt. It's such a simple little thing, but if they had just thought twice, they'd still have their job. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. It does, but it's interesting that you categorize the stupid little fake cab receipt as stupid and little fake cab receipt. It was still
a fake
cab
receipt.
Yeah, and
it's not at all. You're right. Yeah. It's just as big as a large one. We just perceive it differently.
Right, and if other people have been fired for fabrications on their expense reports before, then people should know better. The responsibility of the company where those things happen, I think, is in making clear to employees this will not stand. You know, we will not tolerate this, and that message doesn't get through, so somebody gets fired and you don't know why they got fired. And so if companies did a better job about letting their employees know, everybody knows they shouldn't cheat on their expense report, but if companies did a better job of letting people know why employees are disappearing from the company, it might get the message out about what they're being fired for. I think that you're absolutely right that there are people who are, and because of what you do for a living, I think you're also more rigorous about.
Isn't it too that if somebody's going to cheat on a stupid little cab receipt, that they cheat on something bigger?
Well, we don't know, and I think that's the thing that comes up with the issue of lying. There are white lies that people say don't hurt anyone, but then it's not that initial lie that often causes trouble. It's the lie you tell to cover the lie, and then the lie you tell to cover that lie. So if you think, you know, someone will cheat on, use a fake cab receipt, and I'm not saying this person would, but if there's someone who would use a fake cab receipt, it's a small step then to say, to ask an employee to say they were at a dinner they weren't at so they could cover the cost of the meal. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it becomes a small step to, you know, cover the cost of your dry cleaning for your entire family. And then receipts are receipts, and, people used to be a lot more creative about stuff. There was an obituary today for an AP reporter in the newspaper, a very well-known guy who was legendary for his expense reports. And when he was questioned on why he had spent $45 a day on meals, he explained that he hadn't had breakfast that day. So that was his way of saying he would have spent more if they had just let him. So I think the question, though, is one thing leads to another, and companies are being rigorous about staying on top of that.
Does that answer your question, Karen?
The question about your grandmother is true. And I also think you should be forgiven. I don't know what the indiscretions were in your early 20s, but...
Oh, we call them tiny, but I think back now with, you know, I'm upset about it. Like, it was sort of like a pen from an office or an extra pad of paper, you know?
Yeah, and there are things we do in our 20s that we don't do in our 40s. And you know, it's not that our values change, it's that our priorities of our values change. And so, I often write about the fact that it's much easier for someone... Maybe not, but I assume it's easier. It might be easier for someone in their early 20s who doesn't have a family to support to tell off a boss and risk losing their job than it is someone in their 40s who has a mortgage and three kids and a spouse. And you might think twice about that and think, hey, do I really want to fall on my sword over this? It doesn't mean you don't think it's wrong, but you're weighing the importance of calling the person into question on it.
Thank you so much.
Yep. Thanks for your call, Karen. 614-292-8513. We have an email from a listener now. Observation. It seems to me that a lot of lies and partial truths are fairly commonplace in political ads, op-ed columns, letters to the editor, and so forth. And I believe that those who write such things know they are disseminating lies or partial truths. However, it seems to me that they justify their writing of such things because they believe their personal goals justify the means of what they have written. Do ends ever justify means? I'm sorry. Do ends ever justify ends in such situations or any situations?
In that in the situation that the listener is describing, I don't believe so. I think in that particular case, I just don't believe lying in political ads is ethical. It's just not right. I think that there are occasions where deception can justify the ends if it's if it involves somebody's safety, but it really depends on the circumstances. Typically, lying it cannot be justified, which is different from withholding information. I mean, it's you know, Cicela Bach, who wrote a great book on lying, talks about truth dumping. And if you know someone, if a doctor knows someone's ill and terminally ill, they can describe that they're terminally ill and tell them that they're going to die without dumping the truth on them and be excruciating in the detail about what will happen. I mean, there's a judgment that goes on with that.
Want to give us a call? 614-292-8513. My guest is Jeff Seglin. He is the writer of The Right Thing. It's a column in the Columbus Dispatch on Sundays. He is syndicated, and it's published all over the country. And Terry, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Jeffrey, you just made a comment a couple of moments ago, which made me wonder. I tend to be on the left side of the political spectrum, tend to be a Democrat, and I've noted, well, very much a Democrat, but I've noticed, I've often wondered if the sort of ethical backgrounds of the parties have ever been studied, and I wonder if the few Republican friends I have, they tend to be more rules-based versus, I tend to think that Democrats tend to be more big-picture, holistic-based.
You know, I don't know that anyone's looked at that. I think that I don't know. I don't know that there's anything that would lead me to believe that that's anything other than indicative of your friends. But there's, in thinking about the sort of Democrat versus Republican ethical behavior, at least in this most recent campaign of when lies have been or fabrication of backgrounds has come out, it's been on both sides. You know, it doesn't know party lines. But I don't know. That's a very interesting question. I don't know if there's something about the political party or the political stance that leads people to do that. I wouldn't think so because it's such a broad category, particularly the Democratic Party is such a broad category, whether you're, you know, a moderate Democrat. I just don't know.
Right. I guess the Republicans have the perception of being able to sort of walk in lockstep with one another. And I jokingly look at my friends and say, gosh, you were toilet trained at gunpoint.
You say that because you're a Democrat. They might just be being organized.
Right.
I think there's a perception that they're more organized, but I don't know that that means they're different in the way they think about ethics.
Right.
So I think that you'd probably find people in both parties or groups of people in both parties that would be emblematic of how you described your friends, your Republican friends. I would guess, but it would be an interesting study to do, and I bet somebody right now is doing their PhD on it.
Thanks for your call, Terry.
Sure.
Take care. 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Susan. She writes, I have a question about the difference between ethics and morals. There is much talk in the media, for example, via Glenn Beck, about Christian values, which I think means morals. I am not a Christian. I am not a believer in any religion. Can I have morals, or would the correct term be ethics?
She's asking lots of questions.
Mm-hmm.
The question is yes. She can have morals and she does have values. The way I describe it to students in a very simplistic way is that when you think of morals and values, that's the personal level. When you think of ethics, that's the societal way about how we believe what's acceptable as a society and as a group. So it goes to a different layer. And then when you get into the professions, medical ethics or journalist ethics or other kinds of ethics, that's, you know, ethics specific to a group of people. So the Hippocratic Oath and beyond, you know, the vast majority, there's a whole wide variety of medical ethics that would be very specific. So it goes from morals and values on the individual level. I don't think you need to be, in fact, I'm confident you don't need to be religious to have morals and values. I believe everyone has values. They might not be values I or you approve of, mm-hmm. but everyone has value.
Okay.
Was that clear enough?
That was clear to me, but it was an emailer, so we can't. they want to write back. Sally, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
I wonder how far do I have to go to right what I think is a wrong? And the instance for me is a service company who bills me every 3 months. I suddenly realized this summer that I hadn't had a bill from them in some time, so I called them up right away, and they said that I didn't owe them any money. And I know that they're wrong. I do owe them some money.
Right.
So I called, and I said, they said, well, you've had credit. And I said, but I can't have credit. I haven't paid you since the February cycle, which would pay me up through May, and I haven't had a bill all summer. So she looked all my records up and everything. She said, you won't be billed to the November cycle. And I said, well, how can that be? And she said, well, your account's been credited. And I said, but what's the credit? I haven't paid you anything.
You may have a little fairy godmother or godfather out there.
But I think you're doing exactly the right thing. I think you're bringing up to them, no, I haven't paid this, and I'm I want to make good on the service that I'm receiving. I think that's the right thing to do. There was a guy a couple weeks ago who wrote me from the Philippines where he had the same thing happening with his company, and it was a pest control company where they came in every year, and the contract was supposed to be up every year. And this company, the pest control company, never renewed the contract or indicated they're renewing the contract. So every year they'd stop billing, and yet they would keep doing the services. And it took him forever to get them to realize, you know, we owe you money for doing this service, and fundamentally, you owe them money for doing the service, and you're doing the right thing by trying to get them to see that. Because I look at this as kind of like when you're at an ATM. If the ATM gives you $1,000 and you ask for $100, legally you can't keep that money.
Mm-hmm.
You may keep it for a little while, but when they come to you and say, we want our money back, you have to give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
Ethically, I don't think there's a difference here. There may be legally a difference, and I don't know what the law is in Chicago, in Columbus about that, or in various states, but I think there's an obligation to make good on that.
Maybe put it in writing.
Or get them to put it on writing. As long as they say in writing, you don't owe us, then it's clear. They're giving you the service for free for whatever reason. But I think somebody should put it in writing. But it's very honorable that you're trying to make good.
And who is this, and how can I get their service? I'm just kidding.
What else will they pay for me?
Well, it's a nationally known company. I know they've made a mistake. And mm-hmm. my wondering is, how much further do I go to try to make this right?
I would try to have them put it in writing, because at some point they may come to you and say they found the mistake. And then they're going to want to be paid in arrears for that, or they might want to be paid in arrears for that, which would be a little ridiculous given how much they're fighting for you not to pay them, which is a little unusual.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. I don't think I've ever had that.
I think you're doing exactly the right thing. There's just so much. All of us have dealt with customer service people who are great people. I mean, they have the most thankless job. They're like the IT department of a company where you only call them when something's wrong. We've all dealt with customer service people, though, where it's just impossible to figure out how to resolve something, mm-hmm. and at some point you have to get on with your life. You've tried to do the right thing by making clear to them that you know you are receiving a service you haven't quite paid for.
But that's a good idea. Get it in writing so that they can't, you know, charge you interest or anything like that, right, Jeff?
Or even want the money back for those months that you know you owe them for.
Okay, Sally, thanks for your call.
Okay.
Take care. 614-292-8513. We have about 4 minutes left and a few calls here. Let's get to them right now. Lynn, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I was not raised in this country, and, you know, I was raised to believe that honesty was the most important thing. And I wondered if the guest was aware or had noticed that while I was staying home with my child several years ago, I was constantly explaining to him that the TV shows, commercials, sitcoms, and things where they portrayed people lying, and it was supposed to be funny.
Yes.
And he was small, he was tiny, and I was saying, you know, that little boy's lying to mommy, his mommy, and they think it's funny, but it's not funny. And I was continually doing that over the 5 years I stayed home with my son. And I wondered if you had noticed that, and are you aware of it? Am I the only one that notices it?
No, you're not. There's an advertisement that drives me nuts from IKEA, a company that whose stuff I think is great. But there's a they do an annual sale, and there's a woman who walks out from the register, and she sees her receipt, and she looks at it, and it's clear she thinks she's been undercharged. And as she's walking to her car, her husband's in the car, and she shouts, start the car, with the idea that she's going to get away with something. And it drives me nuts because the perception is that we're trying to pull a fast one on people. I think companies are sending an odd message. It's funny. I don't mean to be humorless or anything, but it does send. It's a message that doesn't need to be sent, and I think that, I do notice it in advertisements.
It's aimed very much towards children. It's on Leave It to Beaver, where somebody tells a white lie to the mother. It's continual in children's programs.
Well, I think it shows a lack of creativity at any level. And Leave It to Beaver, though, there's usually a message at the end about why it's not good.
Yeah, there's a moral to the story, usually.
Yeah, you probably turn it off because you're offended at the beginning and don't see that, Beaver gets taken up on the charge and stuff. But I do think it's in advertising, and I think it shows a total lack of creativity. I think that, some people may perceive it to be a small thing. I don't. I think that it sends a bizarre message to people that we should want to get away with things.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lynn, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Don't be hard on the beef. 614-292-8513. We have just actually really enough time for just one more call. So, John, you're it. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. You were discussing the distinction between ethics and morals earlier, and I'd like to offer a little refinement that I think morality clearly, ethics is a subset of morality, which includes both ethical and aesthetic morality. So whenever the Bible starts pulling that abomination word out, it's never about someone being harmed or treating others as you would not be treated. It's always purely aesthetic in nature. And I think governments would be well advised to always make that distinction and keep their nose out of questions of taste. So morality is larger than ethics alone.
Yep.
They're not interchangeable terms.
Abomination like homosexuality?
Yeah,
say
that, that's a purely aesthetic judgment. It's not ethical. So I think there is a real distinction made between morals and ethics in that regard.
Okay. He's absolutely right. There is a distinction between morals and ethics, and it's an important one to make.
Yeah. And sometime when we've got lots of time, I'll like to get into the whole question of tribalism and territorialism and whether there's ever any morality to be found in the question of who deserves to live someplace and who doesn't. I think it is the original sin of life on Earth, and far from recognizing it as such, religions tend to embrace their territorial war gods. And that's a big topic, and I'm sorry I got in late on.
Yes.
That's interesting, though.
No, but it's very challenging, yes.
Yeah.
Thank you, John, for your call.
Bye.
Well, maybe Jeff, next time?
You want me to solve tribalism next time?
Yes.
Sure. that would be fun.
That would be fun.
And your listeners are terrific. I mean, I've noticed in the column as well that the letters I get from Columbus readers are just terrific. So
great. Well, thank you very much for being on the show today. I hope you can come back again.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
All righty. That's all the time we have for All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.